was asked to talk about entomology and how it intersects with medicine. And so I thought that what I would do is focus on maybe four major areas where that intersection occurs. And these vary from places that are really well established to things that are more speculative. Not a lot of work has been done yet, but they might have some interesting potential for the future, as well as some areas that I think are maybe not so new in the science, but maybe we could describe them as being rebranded or retargeted to a new audience, and that's resulting in some really interesting new resources being devoted to those areas. So if we start with medical entomology, that of course is the area of our discipline that primarily focuses on insects that have direct and indirect impacts on human health. And you can see that this is an area that's really well populated by just looking at some of the lists of presentations at this meeting. So there's a lot of people already working here, but there's also, I think, a lot of opportunities for new people to get into the field, and you can see that here by looking at some places where there are lots of changes going on. So for example, I think there was a symposium on bed bugs, which haven't been a problem for medical entomologists in the United States for a long time, but have become a problem in the last few years. Insecticide resistant head lice would be another example of that kind of thing. Or newly emerging diseases like West Nile virus and Lyme disease. So whenever we have change, that obviously is going to create the potential for new opportunities for new people entering this field. I think, though, probably everybody in the room could agree that the potential for the most significant impact in your careers probably come from thinking about the insects that vector human diseases, and particularly those that cause the most public health impact globally. And so there I'm thinking of malaria, and I'm thinking of the 1 to 3 million children that die from this disease every year, and the 300 to 500 million cases that occur annually. Obviously has a huge impact on public health. And so a lot of the work that's done in the area of studying vectors of disease is ecological, and it's work that's devoted towards control of these pests. But there are also some areas where we're thinking about direct intervention from the medical perspective. And so that's what I'm going to focus on for the next couple of minutes. And here what I want to talk about is the development of vaccines. Because a lot of people in thinking about medical entomology don't necessarily think about this aspect of it. And I think, again, there's some real potential here. So we can talk about vaccines that will disrupt the development of the parasite in the vector or in the human host. And again, I'm going to use malaria as an example here, but certainly the development of vaccines isn't restricted just to that system. And what you're looking at here is a reflection of the extremely complicated life cycle of the malaria parasite. So there are lots of different stages in both the insect host as well as in the human host. And there are a lot of different parasite proteins that have been targeted as potentially being useful in production of a vaccine. One area, though, that's particularly relevant to medical entomology is in thinking about transmission blocking vaccines. And these are vaccines that are directed at interfering with the development of the parasite while it's in the insect, so while it's in the mosquito. And usually those vaccines focus on parasite proteins, as you see down here, a whole bunch of different parasite proteins that occur on primarily on stages that are only in the mosquito. But it doesn't have to. There are also vaccines that have been developed to target mosquito proteins, so the actual insect proteins. So for example, there was a paper that came out several years ago where vaccines targeted a salivary protein, and this then resulted in the inability of the malaria parasite to actually invade the salivary glands. And similarly, there have been some studies where they have ground up entire midguts and immunized the vertebrate host and shown that those then are not capable of becoming infected. So there are some very interesting things going on there where you're looking at the insect as the source of proteins that might interfere with parasite development. This is some work that has been done in my lab recently. And here what we've got is a mosquito protein that is usually involved in the immune system, but that binds very nicely to the oocyst stage of Plasmodium falciparum on the midgut. And we were successful in knocking out this protein using an RNAi technique. And we found that when the protein is not present, when this mosquito protein is absent, the number of midguts that get infected is dramatically reduced. So the number of parasites go way down, and so does the percentage of mosquitoes that actually become infected. So this particular mosquito protein looks like it's really important for the proper development of the oocyst stage of Plasmodium falciparum, and therefore it might be a good target again for a potential vaccination strategy. So those are vaccines that are developed to block transmission in the insect host. There are also some interesting strategies that focus on the fact that the proteins in the saliva can sometimes facilitate the establishment of the parasite in the human host. So the classic example is a sandfly that transmits a parasite called Leishmania, and there's something in the sandfly's saliva that really seems to need to be there for that parasite to be able to develop. And when it does develop, you get this nasty kind of an ulcer forming in cutaneous leishmaniasis. So again, that possibility of actually vaccinating against the arthropod proteins may be a strategy for prevention of this particular infection. Recently, I discovered that there is a small company that's been formed called Cineria, and their whole idea is to try to focus on the parasites in the mosquito as a source of vaccination. So try to get the sporozoites of malaria, enough of them in these mosquitoes, probably irradiating them, and then using that as a source of inoculum. And this little company, if you're thinking about career development, was very, within the last couple of weeks, looking for an entomologist with experience with rearing of mosquitoes and in mosquito biology. So there's some real opportunities there. So let's move on to the next topic. And here I want to mention briefly some ideas about pharmaceutical entomology. And what I mean there is the idea of trying to use insects as possible sources of novel treatments. People who study medical entomology often get this question from our students on the first day of class, and one of the things that I always talk to them about is maggot therapy. Maggot therapy is derived from some of the old studies during the Civil War and other wars where they discovered that wounds that were infested with certain kinds of insect maggots actually healed better than other wounds that weren't infected. So the maggots are clearly helpful in some contexts. But there are also lots and lots of folk medicines in Asian and in Latin American medical treatments that may focus on insects as potential sources of disease treatment. So Chinese ant powder is one example, and the classic one would be the use of honeybee stings to prevent arthritis. So investigation of these folk medicines may provide some interesting avenues. Another possible avenue for pharmaceutical entomology is the idea of simply randomly screening insects to try to find potential targets that could be useful against, for example, drug-resistant bacteria. And there was a small company that was formed in Australia that had this idea. They weren't going to target any particular insect, but they were going to collect a whole bunch of them of different kinds, extract them, and then see whether they could identify any novel chemistries in those. And here the idea, I think, comes from the plant bioprospecting that's been done over a number of years and is well established as a potential way for finding new chemistries. I don't know how well this company is doing, whether they were able to get subsequent venture capital after they originally set up with this idea, but I thought it was so sort of an interesting direction. So there may be some potential there. Another place where entomology directly intersects with medicine is in the use of insects as models for human disease. And this is primarily based on work in Drosophila melanogaster, and there are now, probably within the last 5 to 10 years, just a whole long list of different diseases for which proteins that exist in the humans have also been found in the insect, and they've been able to many times mutate those proteins and identify syndromes that occur in the insect that are similar to things that occur in the human disease. One of the ways that this can occur is sometimes just through basic biology. So there's been a lot of study in Drosophila of the immune pathways, for example, and how they are responding to injection of bacteria. And one of the areas that has received a lot of attention is how is the transcription of those antimicrobial genes actually regulated. And during those studies, they found a protein called Toll, which is an important receptor for one of these pathways. And that pathway turned out to have a great deal of relevance to human innate immunity, because it turns out there are lots and lots and lots of Toll-like receptors in human biology that are very important in a number of different pathways and responses to a lot of different types of pathogens. So these are under a lot of heavy investigation now at this point as targets for new drug development. So that was just some basic studies. There were also some more directed studies using Drosophila as a model, and one example is a random screening generation of mutants looking for syndromes in the insect that look something like what's going on in humans. Another option is to identify genes and proteins in human disease that may be important and that have a cognate in Drosophila, go back and mutate that and then see what that does to the biology. And a third pathway you see here, where they actually take the human gene, transgene, express it in Drosophila, and then see what happens after that's done. And so, for example, with Parkinson's disease, there's a gene called alpha-synuclein, and they were able to express that in Drosophila and show that that had resulted in a similar sort of a syndrome with effects on the insect's movement. So the last area that I wanted to touch on this morning is conservation medicine. And this area encompasses what I think of as not necessarily new science, but science that's been targeted now to a new audience. And that has resulted in some new funding and some new resources for this area. And the general idea here is to look at the ecology related usually to something that humans are doing that would cause loss of biodiversity, for example, or extraction of natural resources, and then see how that those changes that occur in the ecosystems then will affect transmission of human disease. And if you're interested in this area in general, a number of these studies have been published in a journal called EcoHealth, so you can follow up that way. I just want to give a couple of examples, and I'm choosing these two examples because I know that they were highlighted in a recent request for applications from the EPA, which historically has not actually been interested in funding human disease research, but because of this focus on conservation medicine, they had a RFA last summer that was targeted towards biodiversity, changes in biodiversity mediated by humans, and how that was affecting disease. And so the two examples, the first one here is from Richard Ostfeld and his colleagues at the Institute of Ecosystem Studies, and it relates to changes in forest structure and Lyme disease. In particular, he's interested in different sizes, fragmentation levels of forest. And what he's found, or what he's reported, is that in the smaller patches of forest, you tend to get a species poor community. So you get relatively few kinds of birds and few kinds of mammals and a lot of white-footed mice. They do really well in the small patches. And the reason that's important is because the white-footed mice are the best host for larval deer ticks, and they also, so if a larval deer tick gets on a white-footed mouse, it's much more likely to actually be able to molt to the nymphal stage. The white-footed mice are also the best reservoirs for Lyme disease, so it's also much more likely to become infected. In a species-rich community, which is more typical of what you find in the bigger patches, you actually have lots and lots and lots of different kinds of mammals, so probably the risk of these larval ticks of encountering white-footed mouse goes way down, and they're much more likely to encounter a different host. These other hosts are not as good. You can get a tick can get blood from these hosts, but they're just not quite as good as molting into the next stage, and they definitely tend not to get infected because none of the rest of these hosts are as good as reservoirs for Lyme disease as the white-footed mouse is. So he calls this the dilution effect, and it's been a really interesting idea. The second idea that the EPA focused on was the interaction between changes in the forest due to deforestation and malaria transmission. And there had been a lot of different reports over the years about deforestation resulting in increases in epidemic malaria. But there was one study that was done by a researcher named Jonathan Patz and his colleagues, and he was working in Iquitos, Peru. This is Amy Vitor here. And what they discovered in Iquitos was that there were changes in the rate of biting by the major vector, Anopheles darling eye, and that was associated with decreasing forest cover. So you got a lot more biting in the areas that were the most deforested. That makes sense. I don't think to a medical entomologist that finding would be really very surprising, that if you change the habitat in ways that would promote certain species over other species, darling eye likes the more open areas, that you would then tend to get higher populations of darling eye, and that would result in more biting and potentially more malaria transmission. But it was actually targeted to, I think, a different audience, the results of those studies. So people and much more involved in sort of the medical end rather than the entomology end took quite an interest in that, and I think that coupled with the Osfeld studies resulted in the EPA request. So I'm just going to finish up by saying that I think that there are a lot of opportunities for career development and for having a big impact, and that we're probably on the frontier of the biomolecular prospecting idea, the idea of looking at insects for potential molecules to solve problems of disease really hasn't been explored in much detail. We know that the model idea, using Drosophila as a model, works well, has contributed a lot to a number of different diseases. We don't know whether some of the other insects for which genomes are now available might also not be of use in this context. They certainly don't have exactly the same suite of tools that we have with Drosophila, but there may be some differences in biology that would be useful. And I think a greater recognition of the relationship between changes, ecological changes, and health also has the potential to be a really interesting place to invest yourself in the next 20 years or so. So with that, I'll finish, and thank you for your attention.